From KCRW, I'm Kim Masters, and this is The Business. Director Rod Lurie's new movie, The Outpost, is a video-on-demand success story that almost never was. Based on Jake Tapper's book, The Outpost, An Untold Story of American Valor, the film follows a group of soldiers who battled a deadly Taliban attack in a remote part of Afghanistan. This project met with obstacles every step of the way, budget constraints, an actor's broken ankle. But the real tragedy came when Lurie was called away from the production in Bulgaria due to the unexpected death of his son, Hunter. Lurie tells us why this terrible loss turned the movie into a mission.
There was real talk that the movie had to shut down. But Kim, it was like, no way. There's just no way this movie is going to shut down.
But first on the News Banter, Ted Sarandos rules Hollywood. Stick around, it's The Business from KCRW. I am joined by my colleague in banter, Matt Bellany. Hello, Matt.
Hi there.
So our friends at Netflix, they had their second quarter earnings call very, very recently. And while the reaction on Wall Street was not so good because of some disappointment in terms of what they announced in numbers, which I will mention shortly, they did also say that they are promoting Ted Sarandos, who has been the head of content. I was really, I have to admit, you know, time is very weird during the pandemic, but also generally, when I saw Ted Sarandos, a 20-year veteran of Netflix, I felt like, wait, what? 20 years? But that's the reality. And he is now co-CEO of the company with Reed Hastings, the founder.
Yeah, I mean, this really is an acknowledgement of what Netflix has become, which is a content powerhouse. I mean, this is driving the train. Content is king at Netflix. And this is the guy that, as you mentioned, from the very beginning when they were hawking DVDs and he was going door to door trying to get libraries of old movies to send in those red envelopes. I mean, Ted Sarandos has been there from the beginning. And look at where Netflix is now. They are clearly the dominant content studio in Hollywood. They are producing more content per year than any studio in the history of the entertainment business. And he's now the co-CEO of the company. It makes perfect sense.
Yeah, I mean, it's part of my, you know, my little thing that I like to talk about, how Netflix inches closer and closer to doing the things the old Hollywood way when they came in, as these digital companies tend to do, saying we're reinventing the wheel. It, you know, content is king. That's the way it is. Talent has to be treated well. That's the way it is. You know, and Netflix is going in that direction. I mean, who knows? They may end up buying the Paramount lot. So then they really will have gotten there.
They already have a huge footprint in LA. I mean, the building in Hollywood where they're located is not insignificant, and they've got pods all over LA. But Reed Hastings, the other CEO, is based in Los Gatos in Silicon Valley, as are a number of the C-suite executives and a lot of the tech employees. This essentially will acknowledge that the LA-based operation is on equal, if not greater, footing than that Los Gatos portion of the company. And, you know, you can say what you will about Netflix and whether they treat artists well. They've certainly cut some very big checks. They've essentially eliminated the back-end formula that has powered Hollywood for, you know, 30, 40 years and made a lot of multi-millionaires out of talent. But they are the dominant studio right now. And, you know, this is the way it is.
Yeah, that's the way it is. I mean, they did say, and the shares did fall right after they announced their numbers, that they were not going to get as many new subscribers as Wall Street had hoped, and that some of their earnings were lower. But, you know, Netflix just keeps on ticking. A lot of people are like, how can they spend all this money and not implode? And yet they keep doing it. So I guess it must be working for them, or enough people believe that it will be working for them.
Yeah, but it's those subscriber numbers. I mean, they added 10 million subs this quarter. They're up to 193 million subs worldwide. That's huge. And it's such a vast advantage over all these other companies that are trying to compete in the streaming space. And as long as those sub numbers stay high, and this pandemic, for all the chaos that it has wrought, it is helping them get these subscribers because people are stuck at home and looking for entertainment options. And as long as those numbers keep going up, the stock market will believe in the future of Netflix.
I will note they said growth is slowing as consumers get through the initial shock of COVID and social restrictions. But since things are going badly in a large part of the country, maybe people will go back to the shock that I think is warranted about how this pandemic is just raging. Let me pivot to something that could or could not be a big story. As you know, there has been this war where the Writers Guild asked its members to fire their agents, and the great majority of them did, over the packaging fees that the agencies collect and the fact that the agencies were getting into production, which they felt the writers feel is a conflict of interest, to have someone who is negotiating for you then become the content creator that you work for. Jay Suris at UTA had tried to broker a deal earlier. The other agencies wouldn't go along and went nowhere. And then suddenly they say they have a deal. But this deal is like, what is this deal? And it seemed like it could be poised that ICM and CAA would join and make a deal. But then there's like this pause, and I'm not sure what the deal guarantees.
Well, here's what we know about this, is that UTA has agreed to cap their interest in a production company at 20%, which is a big concession. Some of these other companies like CAA and WME, they have majority owned production entities, which give them a majority ownership interest in the employer of their clients in certain instances. So that's one concession. They've also agreed to end packaging in 2 years, but they have to get another agency of the big four, they call them, to agree to do this. And a lot of speculation is that ICM, which is arguably a big agency, it's much smaller than CAA or WME, that ICM is going to negotiate to sign this agreement as well. So there will be those two agencies. And what big picture this means is there will likely be two agencies, WME and CAA, that will not agree to any of this stuff and will continue to package and to own the shows that their clients are producing in certain instances. And then there will be the rest of the agency business, which will include likely ICM, UTA, Gersh, Paradigm, and the others, who are agreeing to these terms that the Guild is putting out there and can represent in an official capacity writers. That's a big deal, because these bigger companies, they just see the advantage of producing, and they're essentially saying, we're just going to be in a different business than the other agencies who are going to agree to these limitations.
I don't know. I mean, I have reason to suspect that CAA has at least inquired about being involved, in which case WME, which is the most heavily involved in production and really can't agree to these terms, would be the one agency that didn't find a way to make a deal. But we'll see what happens. Thank you, Matt.
Thank you.
That's Matt Bellany, former editorial director of The Hollywood Reporter. The Outpost, directed by Rod Lurie, was a surprise hit over the 4th of July weekend. It's sitting at 92% on Rotten Tomatoes, and to the extent that video on demand numbers are available, it seems to be a commercial success too. CNN's Jake Tapper was inspired to write the book that was the basis for the movie, just as he became a new father.
My son was born on October 2nd, 2009, my son Jack, and the attack was October 3rd, 2009, the next day. And I was sitting in the hospital room holding my son and listening to the news tell me about the attack on Combat Outpost Keating and these eight other sons taken from this earth. And so that poignant moment was what set me on the journey to find out who these men were and why they were there and the whole project.
Tapper's book was optioned and naturally went through some Hollywood twists and turns before the project found its director in Rod Lurie, a West Point graduate and director of The Contender and The Last Castle.
I'm lucky not only that it got done, but that it got done well by Rod. It started off that Paul Tamasi and Eric Johnson reached out, and they had written The Fighter. And I know enough about Hollywood to know that egos often get in the way of good work being done. That people demanding this and that, often what that does is just put up roadblocks, and the road is already so blocked. So I just said, okay. And, Rod and I hit it off immediately. I'm a huge fan of The Last Castle. That is now my second favorite Rod Lurie movie. And, you know, he went to West Point, and I think that was really an important part of it for me, because this movie needed to be authentic, it needed to be real, and it really needed to focus not on the politics or anything like that. It really needed just to be about these guys stuck in this awful place.
So it started at Universal. Sam Raimi was involved, then he decided maybe he wasn't the right guy after all. Then one of the other soldiers who had won the Medal of Honor, Clint Romichet, he was going to do a book, and it looked like Sony would do it. Are you just familiar with Hollywood enough to go like, yep, that's how it works? Or were you thinking, oh my God, this thing is never going to happen?
Well, actually, I mean, I think Clint is an American hero, and his book came out years after mine, but I offered to combine our projects, 60-40, he'd get the 60 and I'd get the 40. But, you know, he didn't want to. His book is his view, and look, it's his story more than it's mine. And I knew enough to say that, okay, you know, probably the odds are neither of these are going to be made, but I wished him well, and that was the end of it.
So you end up at Millennium, and since it is a critical and commercial success, I feel like I can sort of say Millennium isn't known as the home of prestige projects. And I'm not sure, Rod, were you brought in by Millennium? I'm a little mushy on the chronology there.
No, I was brought in by Paul Tamasi and Eric Johnson, the writers, and Paul Merriman, who worked for Sam Raimi. I actually was I was invited to go and visit with Sam, and all those guys were there. And Sam was just said, you know, I don't think that this is the movie for me. I don't think he wanted to get into a true story. He was much more comfortable in the fantasy world. And they may have gone to a few other directors before me. In fact, they probably did, since I was...
I read somewhere where you said you thought you were probably the fourth or fifth choice because you had had a bomb. You had had Straw Dogs that didn't do well.
Yes. The last time I spoke to you was when you interviewed me about Straw Dogs, and you know, that movie had a rape scene, and so it just killed the movie, and I was in a sort of a director jail, and so I assumed that I was deep down the line, and I may have been down even deeper had I not had a military background, and these guys happened to be a fan of a couple of my films. And to be honest, I couldn't do the movie when I wanted to. I was going to do another project. But when I came back, the guys all meet me at Art's Deli in the Valley, the famous Art's Deli.
Where every sandwich is a work of art, yes.
Yes, and like there are a lot of business deals that are done there at, you know, at a lower level, or you know, a lot of old-timers are there. And they say to me that they want to make a mini series out of Jake's book. And I thought, I don't want to know if I want to go that route, because there's certainly enough story for it. But I thought that it might become repetitive. And I wasn't sure it would work as well or emotionally as well as a film. And Paul Tamasi, the writer, says, you know, I think Millennium had wanted to do this. And I said, well, if they're willing to put money into it and if they're going to do it properly, then let's go talk to them. And I believe literally, Kim, the next day we were there and we made a deal in the room. But there were caveats, because as you said, look, you say non-prestige projects. I want to be a bit more polite and say that they're extremely efficient at making mid-budget level action films. But I said to them, you know, this is a war film. It's not an action film. And I told them, I want to use real veterans in this film. And they said, okay. Then I told them the crew I wanted to use, and they said, okay. And then I said, and I want to shoot almost the entire movie in oners. And they said, okay, but it was much slower coming. That okay.
You said you wanted to shoot the entire movie in what? I'm sorry, I didn't quite hear the word.
We wanted to shoot the entire movie in oners, meaning that I wanted to shoot every sequence I would shoot in a single shot.
This is pre-1917, of course, which is the one-shot movie.
Yes, now, I'll tell you, 1917 is a masterpiece, and it's one of my favorite war films of all time. And it is intended to look like one long shot, but it's not the oneer that it's famous for. It's making it look like it's a oneer.
Right.
And we, you know, just because of budget, we're forced to actually do it in mostly in these oneers. I just thought it would be a very immersive experience. And I also thought after seeing Dunkirk that really, you really had to be creative with war films. So to their credit, Millennium, Avi Lerner, Jeffrey Greenstein, you know, Jonathan Younger, all those dudes, they sucked it up and said, okay, we'll take a chance and we'll do this, even though it went against some of their own filmmaking instincts. But lo and behold, they stuck to their word. I have to give them credit for that.
Coming up after a short break, Lurie talks about why the loss of his son ultimately strengthened his resolve to finish making The Outpost. You're listening to The Business from KCRW.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is The Business, and I'm Kim Masters. We're talking to Rod Lurie, director of The Outpost, and Jake Tapper, author of the book on which the movie is based. Production of the film faced many obstacles that could have shut it down. The most tragic of all came during the summer of 2018. Lurie tells the story.
We were in prep. I was in a Bulgarian pub. We were going to watch the World Cup when my mother called me and said that my son Hunter had a car. Well, she didn't know what happened to him. She knew he was in a hospital in Michigan, and the hospital told me that he had a cardiac arrest. And the nurse, who was about as cold as can be, just said, you know, I said, well, I'm going to have to get there. She goes, well, he's not going to make it. Mm. But my wife, Kira, and my ex-wife, and Hunter's mother, Gretchen, my daughter, and his girlfriend, they flew to Michigan. They beat me to the punch, obviously. It was a hell trip, you know, being on this plane, not knowing a thing because there was no internet. And I got there. It was really profound, Kim, because, you know, I got there and he's all hooked up and it is hopeless. And I had to make the decision to remove all the machines. And we were told he's got about 20 minutes left.
Wow.
He's unconscious. And my daughter said to me, my daughter had the presence of mind to say to me, Paige, she said, you know, Dad, I know that the last thing you want to do is go make a movie, but you have to go make this movie, you know. My son was, he was a movie fanatic. And if he knew that this movie, based on Jake's book, based on these guys, you know, went down the tubes because they definitely were looking for other directors, which they should have been. But it would be difficult to mount this film with its leader just disappearing like that. But it would have destroyed Hunter. But I realized something else. Literally as he expired from this earth, I realized he was the same age.
Yes.
Right, Jake? As these guys. They're like, they're all in their 20s. And now these families get behind me. And Jake was wonderful and, you know, did something about Hunter on CNN. And the families are sending me, you know, gifts and flowers. And they're really behind me. And I realized then how important it was to the movie that we get the deaths of these men correct. You know, I knew if I was making a movie about, or somebody was making a movie about Hunter's death, I wouldn't want to have a musical score behind it. I wouldn't want to have the traditional stuff that you get in action films. You know, I'd want it to be real. And
yes, meaningful.
I mean, I got there. Kim, I got there. And this crew behind me, it was unreal. It was unreal. You could play the Rocky music. Mm. And we overcame everything. I mean, this movie is so difficult to mount. You know, we didn't have enough money. We didn't have enough time. The location wasn't perfect, but it would be made perfect maybe by CGI. We didn't have, you know, we didn't have what we needed. But these guys, they came together and it was just like unbelievable what happened there in Bulgaria for this film.
I mean, you know, Rod, I offered condolences then and I offer them again now. That's a heartbreaking story.
Thank you.
It's funny in a way because the movie had so many obstacles and yet felt destined at the same time. And just to underscore that point, I will say that when you return and started shooting, Scott Eastwood broke his ankle. I don't know if you broke his ankle while you were in the US, Rod, or whether you returned and then he broke his ankle, but his ankle broke.
No, I returned and Jonathan Younger, the producer of the film, he comes in and he says, we just got word, guess what? That Scott Eastwood broke his ankle and it's going to be like months before he's fixed. And basically we're screwed. And there was real talk that the movie had to shut down. But again, Kim, it was like, no way. There's just no way this movie is going to shut down. And I got on the phone with Scott, and he said, I'm going to make it. I promise you, I'm going to make it. He really wanted to do this film. And so I had to get on the phone with the insurance company and do a dance like I'm Fred Astaire. Like, explain to them how I'm going to reschedule the entire movie. We're going to begin with the shots of Scott's character sitting, and then I'm going to shoot the scenes with him standing, and then the ones where he steps like 2 or 3 feet, and then I'm going to shoot all of Caleb Landry Jones's action scenes, and then we'll do Scott at the end. And they said okay. They gave me another 2 weeks. They delayed production by another 2 weeks, which allowed me to rehearse all these very intricated action sequences.
Right.
And, you know, ended up helping us. But Scott's in a lot of pain making this movie. And some of the wincing there is not just like a Clint Eastwood-like squinting and gritting. It's like he's in pain.
He's in actual this movie. Yeah. Well, amazing that they allowed you to go forward. I mean, the insurance issue alone would be something that I would think, you know, would be a huge problem. And then, as if we haven't had enough fun, you were supposed to go, I guess, to South by Southwest. I know you were so looking forward to this. Rod, I know, was Jake. I'm assuming you were going to go too, right?
Yeah, I go every year anyway. CNN has a presence. Yeah.
And I'm sure Rod, I know Rod, because I remember at the time you were emailing me. You were like,
yeah.
This was not only supposed to be the emotional high point of getting to see this movie with an audience in a setting like South by, but you were looking for a distributor.
Right. And I will say that it was a gut punch not to be at South by Southwest. The bigger gut punch in a way for me was that we were then supposed to premiere at West Point. And this was going to be like, I was a terrible cadet. I mean, I was the worst cadet. But I'd always dreamed I want to come back on this stage one day. This was going to be it.
Right.
And then they sent all the cadets home. By the way, you brought up the issue of the distributor. I cannot tell you how grateful we are that we're being distributed right now by Screen Media, who knows exactly what they're doing in this world. And the VOD has just been beyond belief successful, as you know, as is empirically known. There's literally nobody else I'd rather be with now than this company. They have got their act together.
I don't know whether you, I know for you, Rod, the big screen experience was so important. You felt at the time. Now you've had to live without that, but you have this success. Mm-hmm. So what's the net on that?
Well, okay, I would still love it to be seen in on the big screen, because that's how I designed the film. And if I had known that it would be mostly for television screens, I might have shot it differently. But you know, the professional work, the sound work, and the color timing on the film, I thought it would not work out well on TV, but it turns out to work out extraordinarily well. And without a doubt, more people have seen the film now, even on VOD, than they would have in theaters. And, you know, I don't know if Jake is like me, but I go on Twitter every day and I just read all the comments from vets and all these people that have seen the film and seem to love it. And there's no chance we would have had these thousands and thousands of outpouring if it was in theaters. Because, you know, every time there's a VOD, it's more than just one person watching it. It's usually a family watching it. Mm. And so the amount of eyeballs on this film is really amazing. And, you know, I what can I tell you? I'm very happy. And by the way, this is going to be a new normal, Kim. You know, you're going to be interviewing a lot of filmmakers a year from now who's, you know, without any COVID to worry about, whose movies, very respectable, excellent movies, great movie stars, going right to VOD, and they're going to do it without blinking an eye, because it's going to be a way to make money.
Because the pandemic has trained people up that they can actually do this, I think, and that was the strategy Universal did with Trolls.
Yeah, I mean, I think that they did a good thing, and I love the theatrical experience. It is a little bit of a downer and a bummer that it's not, but you know, we're all at home. We're not spending, you know, money on the parking. We're not spending money on, you know, buying several tickets. You know, we have the popcorn at home is less expensive than the popcorn at the theater. There's no babysitter to pay, and so if you can get high quality, I'm begging people not to watch this movie on a computer or their iPad or, God forbid, their phone. But
bigger the screen, the better. Yes.
Yes, of course.
And Jake, I assume you also are feeling that somehow this worked out in a way that maybe you wouldn't have dreamed of as a good thing in the initial going, but now has been really satisfying for you too. I do have to ask, though, you know, with these reports now of the bounties that Russia is said to have paid on U.S. troops, does that add another layer to your feeling about what is depicted in this film? Because as a viewer, I have to say it did for me.
So I think that that story breaking reminded people, A, that we have troops over there who are still dying. And then B, here comes this film to talk about that, talk about these people as real people. And certainly when I did some publicity for the film that week, the week that it came out, that was something that people made that connection. And I think naturally so. Kim, one other thing I just wanted to say, because I know you like to talk about the business, and there's one thing that I don't think Rod has, and I have talked about yet, which is the incredible set design and production design done in Bulgaria. They recreated the entire combat outpost, and there were three veterans who Rod hired to be consultants, producers, actors on the film. Three veterans of Combat Outpost Keating. There were more than veterans than that, but just three that had actually served there. Ty Carter, one of the Medal of Honor recipients, Dan Rodriguez, who plays himself in the film, and a guy named Hank Hughes, who served there in 2007, 2008, who plays Brad Larson and also is in film. And all three of them said that it was so weird being on the set, because it was so much like Cop Keating. They had done such an incredible job placing everything where it was placed. They were spooked by how good a job Rod and his team had done.
Jake Tapper is the author of the book, The Outpost, An Untold Story of American Valor. Rod Lurie is the director of the film, The Outpost. I want to thank both of you so much for joining us.
Oh, it's our pleasure. Thank you so much, Kim.
Yeah, this was really cool. My wife is really excited I'm on with you, Kim.
And that's The Business. Kevin Tidmarsh produced and edited today's program with help from Mario Diaz. Ray Guarna mixed the show. You can stream The Business as well as other great KCRW podcasts on the KCRW app. I'm Kim Masters. We'll see you next week on The Business.